I would never have thought that.
That's right. Okay, this is an interview with Nikki Dimitropoulos on the 31st of January 2018, held at Mile End at Nikki's home. This interview is part of the Women's History Project of the Women's Information Switchboard, later Women's Information Service. Thank you, Nikki. Would you like to start our interview by giving us your name and a brief overview of when and where you were born and grew up?
Nikki Dimitropoulos. I was born on the 5th of May 1958, and I was born at the Western Community Hospital, which was in what is currently my neighbourhood of Mile End, and grew up probably two houses down the road from where we are now.
Really?
Which was my parents' first house, and then they bought the property at number 64 Rose Street. Initially, there was a huge house on the block with a lot of land on it, which allowed my father to end up with about 250 rabbits in the backyard, but that's another story, and chickens and all of that sort of thing. So growing up, I went to Theverton Primary School, which again was across the road from where I lived. Later, I went to Adelaide Girls High School. At the end of high school, a couple of things happened. I was accepted to do a social work course at the South Australian Institute of Technology, where the courses were run back then. But my father got very, very ill at that time. He had diabetes, but his kidneys were failing and he had major heart problems. Mm. And they had just, my parents had just built a new home and four units on the property. And because of some kind of bizarre financial arrangement that they had made with the bank, had they paid the property off, if they were able to pay the property off within 5 years, then they would be charged no interest. It was like an interest-free loan for that time. So I went to work because Dad couldn't work the heavy work he was doing. I was lucky enough to be employed by the State Library under a state unemployment scheme, and I did that for just over 2 years, and I worked in cataloguing information back then. That's where I developed some of my information skills, and also being in charge of things like rare books and Australiana. So that was fantastic for me because I love literature. I also worked in the newspaper section, which was the home of what was then to become Switchboard, but I was downstairs, not upstairs. I elevated, going upstairs later. At the end of that two-year period, I had intended to go back to uni in March. However, under the requirements of back then, social security, unemployment benefit requirements, I needed to register with Social Security. That I have to get Centrelink and Social Security clear. Social Security at that time, because I was technically unemployed, even though I was going to be a student, and they set me for an interview. And I was told that I would be required to go to an interview at the Department of Premier and Cabinet. And I thought to myself, I had turned 20. I was just 20 years old. And I thought, oh, no way will I get this because, you know, I'm 20, Greek, no, anyway. So I went along to this interview and I remember this so clearly. I was interviewed by probably at that time five of the state's most powerful women, including Andy Sebastian, Wendy Bowen, Eve Reppin, who else is there? Oh, Deborah McCulloch as the women's advisor, and one other woman from education. Can't remember her name. It will come to me later. So these five women interviewed
me. Eleanor Ramsey?
Eleanor Ramsey?
She was in education. Oh, was she? I'm just trying to think of names.
Or maybe someone before Eleanor Ramsey?
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah, anyway. Five women, and the interview was, I was being interviewed for 2 hours. And I still remember some of the questions. I was informed that the idea was that there would be an information service established for women and women only. And what did I think about that? And what did I feel about that? And I told them, obviously. And the one thing I remember most clearly was Eve Reppin, who turned around and said to me, "Oh, if a lesbian came into the office and she wanted information from you, what would you do?" And I didn't realise this at the time. I mean, I answered her that I'd give the woman the information that she was after. Thinking that was an odd question to ask me because I was being asked about an information service. I thought that was bizarre. I only found out later, after I was given the position, that one of the things that kind of gave me the big tick was the look on my face, apparently, when Eve asked me that question, like, "Are you really dumb or are you thinking I'm dumb?" Yeah. That was a really bizarre question. Anyway, so apparently I did well in that interview. But I, you know, at that time, especially when I was younger, I became very much involved in my local community, and I was already promoting women's issues from the age of 17 or 18. In fact, I started in high school, but that's another story. So the migrant women's thing was always a big thing, and I was also involved with a community youth network, which was for young people who were unemployed. And through my work with them at, I don't know, 17, 18, something like that, we managed to convert that particular service into a truly multicultural service, where we provided services specifically for people who are from a non-English speaking background, but also from Aboriginal backgrounds. And we did that as a normal thing to do. We weren't directed to do that. It was just something that evolved and was very much part of our collective conscious back then. At 18, I was appointed by the Premier to the Adelaide Community Development Board. And the community development portfolio was, as I got to understand later, when I became more politically aware, was a department that was set up for Bannon in terms of part of his grooming for a more active role in politics, which I think was a Dunstan's big mistake, but that's another issue.
Okay. So you and the other paid staff at Switchboard, to my knowledge, you were all employed under some employment scheme, the scheme or something, wasn't it?
Yep, initially.
Initially, everyone started on it was a six-month funding or one-year funding.
Yeah. No, we had one-year funding, and the premise under which we were initially employed and the model under which we were initially employed was what they called a collective model, meaning there was no hierarchy. Well, no obvious hierarchy, no hierarchy in terms of pay or conditions. It was all the same. However, human beings being what they are, that changed, and the type of work and the attitudes towards the paid staff and each other changed in that time. But that more of that later. I think after the first year, Dunstan resigned. He resigned for a number of reasons of his own. And then we had an election and David Tonkin got in. And I still remember the day after the election where we met at Switchboard and we were taking down all the quasi-political or political posters and talking about our future and whether we had one, and we were basically saying goodbye to each other, I think, at that time. But earlier that year, what we had done is we had set up several support structures, and one was the Women's Information Switchboard support group and a political support group. So that was very strategic, I think,
thank Betty Fisher.
Betty
Fisher was the woman who set up the support
exactly.
group.
Exactly. She was a phenomenal woman.
She was amazing. And she organised me to make it happen. Yeah. I ended up being the unofficial representative to get the support group together, and I was the liaison person a lot of the time between all the different women's organisations, and that has saved WIS several times over the years.
Absolutely, and Betty was probably the only woman with enough nous to see that we needed political support.
Yes, her and the bit I remember most strongly about setting up that support group is that she said, whatever we do, we have to have a representative from every major organisation. So we had to make sure the Liberal women were on side. We had to make sure...
And they were.
The Catholic Welfare League, the CWA, all the Conservative organisations.
Absolutely.
Everybody was aboard. And still, even up until, I'm not sure if it's still going, but up until the last 10 years, I reckon that support group has kept on meeting over all this time. And when there have been attempts to restrict the service in some way or to close it down,
they've stepped in.
That group has stepped in and shaped up and made sure it hasn't happened. So I need to find out now what's happening about it, because it was, I agree with you, it was critical back then.
Yeah, I agree.
And we have to thank Betty Fisher for all her hard work on that, because she was the one
with the vision.
Not only
for the hard work, but just to have the foresight.
Yeah, she had the vision, and the rest of us, I don't think we'd thought through the long-term implications of it.
I think also, she wasn't... there's a practical reality for that. I mean, politics is a game, and she recognised that. And I think just by nature of the organisation, we should have been apolitical right from the beginning. That's something that I felt very, very strongly, that it didn't matter really where the woman was from, what background the woman had. We were there to provide a service, and nothing else mattered. The background was totally irrelevant. And that's something that I felt very strongly right from the beginning, and probably felt very strongly right from high school. My high school time probably taught me that more than anything. Switchboard consolidated that for me, and consolidated that for me in the sense of giving me the direction later in my professional life and how I saw things like individuality and what my role was in any job to make sure that there was equity and what equity meant for me. Because I found out at Switchboard that equity means different things to different people. And it happens in many professions. I'll choose disability just as an example. Where you talk about equity in a disability context, what people understand is equity for the person with the disability, full stop. They don't understand equity in an organisational cultural sense. They don't understand equity in terms of what is it about me that prevents me from being equitable. They don't understand it from a training perspective. So you look at the way people in the various disability jobs or disability genre jobs are educated. They have no cultural competency skills. They have what they call cultural awareness. That might be a two-hour session once every 2 years, which is nothing. It does not change attitude. So it's not true cultural competency. If you ask them about attitudinal change and shifting paradigms, they don't understand that. If you look at a cultural organisation and look at whether they have lines available for funding for interpreters and translators, that doesn't exist. So the idea of cultural competency is very nebulous, and it's very convenient. If I can say, yes, I've given 2 hours of cultural competence or cultural awareness training to my staff, then I can tick that box, which is not, for me, real equity.
No, it's not enough.
And Switchboard helped me to clarify that and to make it really not only clear for me, but give me the direction that I thought I needed to follow in order to make things better and more equitable. Hence my time at Switchboard, apart from looking after my clients and looking after the women who wanted me to give them information, it was inevitable that Louisa and I almost developed case histories, because the women we were dealing with had nothing.
That's right.
There were no alternatives.
There were no services. Yeah,
there were no services.
There were everything.
We had the Working Women's Centre, and their function was purely to look at issues relating to employment. That's one section of a woman's life. We had the Women's Health Centre doing really important work in relation to women's health. But then there was Louise and myself, and we did everything else, everything from recreation to rape to family law to criminal law to compensation law, everything you could possibly imagine. And I think that aspect of being everything to women with whom we were dealing was something that a lot of the non-ethnic staff found difficult to deal with. We could not refer anywhere. There was nowhere to refer to.
You had no options here.
In relation to providing language assistance, we had no interpreters back then. So idiots like myself felt it very important that I link up with the development of the NATI training course to assist them in developing services that were going to be appropriate for women. Which I did, as well as going with women to provide language assistance, particularly in the areas of mental health. I'm not trained in the area of mental health, but there was no one around. That was it.
Yeah.
So crisis care would call me at 3 o'clock in the morning to go and assist in a family violence situation, for example, because there was no one else to do that. They wouldn't call anyone from the Women's Health Centre or the Working Women's Centre. I was it. And yes, it was my choice whether I go or not. I could say no. But it didn't occur to me back then to say no. Because I knew that there wasn't anyone else. And yes, I was threatened and all of that sort of stuff that came with the job. I thought that was just normal.
Yes, occupational health and safety wasn't really considered very much back then, was it? We were left in that building, that creaky old building on our own, for quite a long time.
Initially, we were open 12 hours a day.
I know,
7 days a
with
week.
No other, sometimes you'd be the only one there. And now
I
you
know,
think
I
about
remember.
It. Now you think about it, you think how dangerous was that? But back in those days, we hadn't actually thought through that, and we were lucky that all of us had enough nous to deal with whatever situations we encountered and survive.
Yeah. Well, I think we did more than survive. I think we were able to use that to the women's advantage for women. Like setting up the custody exchange thing. That was one of the most extraordinary things that I think Switchboard ever did.
A safe environment for handover.
So, you know, because we had those double doors,
yep,
leading, you know, from outside the building to inside where Switchboard was, and we could lock those. We could provide that service, and we dealt with some really violent men.
Oh, yes.
Extremely violent men. And, you know, even when I was called out in the middle of the night, I would just quite bluntly say, you touch me, I will charge you with assault, you will go to jail. Because the police were there with me and the crisis care worker was there. They're all men, but they wouldn't do anything. They just kind of stood there like lumps of
jelly,
meat. But I would be the active one saying, you touch me, you're in jail. Straight away, the police are here, they'll take you straight to jail. So, of course, that acted as a deterrent. But the things that I did that I don't think the Women's Information Service women would do now, because there are so many different protocols that they follow now. But I know quite unashamedly would hide women interstate. I would go in and I would get their children from their homes when their partner was not around, and they could take whatever they could with them, and I would put them on the plane or the train and get rid of them, and they would disappear. I would arrange for women on the other side or wherever they were going to go to make arrangements for them to be safe. Because a lot of the time, women, especially women from non-English speaking background, were not believed. Husbands were believed. The women themselves were not believed. And, you know, I got sick of going to Glenside and hearing from psychiatrists about the mental conditions a battered woman would have, where I could see the bruising and I could see the bandaging because the ribs were broken or whatever, and being told by the idiot psychiatrist that, you know, I'll use a generic name, Maria had a problem because she was hallucinating, calling on the saints to help her.
Why wouldn't she? No one else was.
Like, yeah. Really? And being told that they needed to have electroshock therapy to jiggle the brain about so it could go into place. I thought, I was 22 at the time, 23, thinking, you're nuts yourself. So I'd get rid of the women quite unashamedly and they would be safe. And I'd come across a couple of them when I moved to Melbourne later in my life went shopping in the market. And I had this woman fling herself at me and hug me, and I'm thinking, oh, my God, what's happening here at the Vic Mark? And I looked at her and she said, do you remember me? And, of course, I remembered her. She said, you saved my life.
Yes, yeah.
But we don't do that sort of thing anymore.
I think it's more tricky, too, in this internet age. And with modern communications makes it much more difficult to escape. And family law changing has made women being able to get up and go and move interstate much more tricky. It's really tied them up in knots. Has not necessarily been an improvement.
Well, there are ways.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's still ways and means, but it's still tricky. It's much more difficult now.
But I don't know.
So let's go back to when you started working. You were one of six or eight paid staff. How many were there back in those days?
Come on, me, Louisa, Pamela, Vero. There were six of us, I think.
Andy
was working there for a while.
Yeah, Andy was there for a while till we sort of got Roz Johnson. We said Roz.
So there was Roz, Pamela, Andy, Louisa, me, Pamela Verrill.
Yeah, so it was six, I reckon. Yeah, I think there were six. And there were about 20 of us, 20-odd volunteers.
We realised pretty quickly that we needed volunteers.
Yeah, we weren't going to manage without.
We had what an amazing bunch of women, though. I mean, not only did we have an amazing bunch of women who rallied to us as our support group. But again, the number of volunteers that we had and the longevity of them, some of them stayed with us forever, it seemed.
Some of them gave 10, 20. I reckon some got up to 20 years. There's a volunteer at the moment I know, Pat Ellis, who's just got up to 15 years. So that's pretty impressive, isn't it? 15 years of working in the organisation as a volunteer.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
But the diversity of these women and the diversity of skills that they brought with them was astonishing. And none of them seemed to really get it, especially in the early days. I don't think they really understood how much... I'll say switchboard because that's what it was for all the time that I was. I don't think they understood how much switchboard was dependent on them. I don't think they ever really got it. And I'm not sure that we actually let them know. I think that's one of the failings of the permanent staff. I don't think we did enough for our volunteers back then. We offered them training and development as part of a thank you for doing things. But
we
then
had those
later,
wonderful camps.
Well, yeah, but then later in life when I started working in aged care and disability more so, I realised that we didn't do enough for them, really.
I remember the Kharkov. You know, you feel because, remember that? That was our model of counselling or listening or whatever. That. I know. It still makes me laugh when I think about it.
I think there are a number of issues for me. The training we had was not only inadequate. I mean, I had no training in cultural competency, for example.
Well, there wasn't any back then.
I know.
There wasn't any.
I know.
I mean, you and Louisa were making it up as you went.
I know. And then I went to Melbourne and I developed the handbook for the Victorian Ethnic Affairs Commission on their cultural competency training from my experience, but not only that, from the experience of the others that I worked with. When I was part of the Greek Welfare Workers Association and whatever other groups I was associated with, the CHICH and everything else. And it was important for Louisa and I to be part of those groups because we were so isolated within Switchboard. Mm. We were isolated full stop because we were bilingual workers and everybody was isolated. But even more because we had a feminist bent and we worked primarily with women. On occasion I would work with men who were working for their women and I believed them. That caused a bit of a hoo-ha that I had men visit me at Switchboard, and it's like, well,
sometimes they cared about their sisters or their mothers or their
daughters. Exactly, yes, right. Exactly. And it's like, man's daughter's being beaten up.
I had these calls too.
Yeah, and that's fine. It just, there were just so many kind of inconsistencies, really. And you know how there was a gay line when we first started?
Oh, yeah.
You know the gay line?
Yeah.
I used to have so many women contact me and have to ring gay line because there's nothing for them, like no women's service. So I was the one who established the lesbian line back then, like a million years ago. Mm. And the women's liberation movement, women, got angry with me. And I said, why? And I said, well, you're not a lesbian. I said, so? I'm a woman. I'm working here. I'm getting the calls that I can't deal with. So I think it's more that it's appropriate that we set up a service for women. I said, you're not doing it. Why aren't you doing it?
Mm, that's right. I need someone else to tell them that's what's required.
Mm. So anyway, you know,
went for a while, didn't it? I can't remember.
Yeah,
it did.
And it's
gay women were rostered in.
Absolutely.
To answer those particular calls.
That's the whole point. It was for a lesbian woman to be able to speak to another woman if she was more comfortable to do so. I mean, I was happy to deal with anyone. I had no problem with that.
Yeah, me too.
And I was just so chuffed, you know, when Aboriginal women would come in and I goosebumps up my spine. And I had dealt with some right at the beginning of Switchboard because I had one of my clients was a Greek woman who had been married to an Aboriginal man, so her children were half Aboriginal, half Greek. They identified themselves as being Greek, not Aboriginal. Anyway, so that was my first introduction to the interface between Greek people and Aboriginal people, and there's quite a lot of it. Later, I found out just how much and what the reasons were for that. But putting that aside, I remember Jo Wilmot, who was our Aboriginal worker for a while.
She was the first Aboriginal worker, wasn't she? I learnt a lot from that woman.
Stunning woman. I loved that woman to bits.
Yeah. She's still around.
I know. Yeah. Relationships Australia.
Yeah.
I know. But it was interesting. Joe and I connected really, really quickly. And I think she was very comfortable talking to me. She wasn't so comfortable talking to some of the other women because they were white. And they were very white. Mm. They were also very middle class white. Mm. And I think that's something that evolved probably in about the third or fourth year of Switchboard, not initially, after the hierarchy had been established and that there was one.
Yeah. such as it was. It was a fairly flat structure, though, with a coordinator.
No, not really. I wouldn't say that.
A coordinator and then paid staff. Yeah. That was the hierarchy, really. And then volunteers. And then among the volunteers, there was usually a couple of volunteer representatives who went to meetings and things. That's sort of how it worked, isn't it?
I think it depended on who the coordinator was. For some coordinators, for one coordinator, the delineation was flat. For another coordinator, it wasn't. I think she liked the position of being coordinator. And then we saw the introduction of the middle class clothing. And that's something that impacted on me. Not that I have any kind of middle class fashion sense, and I refuse to. But the designer names were dropped and all of that kind of stuff. And I thought to myself, I don't know how appropriate that is in a place like this.
That's right, yeah.
Really don't know how
clothing
appropriate
that
is.
Clothing is not the most important thing. There are always people like Louisa who were glamorous from day one. And she didn't ever change.
Louisa, you could put in a bloody potato sack and she'd still look like Marlene Dietrich. Yeah. I mean, no, she's just gorgeous.
She did look gorgeous, some of us stayed in our
t-shirts and jeans for a long time, other things like dropping the Alexis George names and whatever names were around at the time, and I thought, not sure about that. Anyway, in time there would be Aboriginal women who would come into the office and they'd look around and they'd point to me and they'd say, I want to talk to her. And for a little while I didn't get why. It took me a little while to work it out. Then I talked to them one day and I said, why'd you pick me? Why me? Mm. And they said, oh, because you look like us. Really? Okay. I wasn't ever sure what that meant. My skin's not particularly dark. I've got dark hair, dark eyes. But I think what they meant is that I didn't look as I'd come out of a fashion page. Mm. That I looked more normal, in quotation marks.
In their view.
And the more I worked, of course, with the Aboriginal women, the more they were asking for me because they talk amongst themselves and they spread information because it's all oral. And I loved that. I have no problem with that. Mm. And I still remember going, in 1984 this was, I still remember the date, the last Women in Labour conference was in Brisbane. And the reason I was allowed to go to that, Louisa didn't want to, is because after the previous Women in Labour conference 2 years prior to that, there was quite a big kerfuffle because ethnic women's issues and Aboriginal women's issues just weren't addressed at all. Mm. So we created a big kerfuffle about that. So 1984 was going to be the year where Aboriginal women's issues and ethnic issues would be the focus. It was migrant women back then, the language.
Yep.
And Aboriginal women. So Joe and I went to Brisbane for this conference.
Oh, that would have been fun, going with her.
Well, yes and no. I mean, she and I were fine. That's not a problem. On the first day of the conference, this is a national conference of enlightened, ideologically sound women who were enlightened enough to realise that we needed an ethnic focus, an Aboriginal focus. Mm. On the first day, where I was running a workshop at that time. It was an access and equity workshop and I was doing something else, I can't remember what, delivering a paper or something. And Joe and I were running the workshop together and I was delivering the paper. I was allocated a room, which was like a broom closet. It was probably the size of a small bedroom. I had 206 women waiting to come into my room to do this workshop.
Yeah, and there was no space.
There was no space for them. Mm. Just down the hallway, there was a lecture theatre that another women's group had where they had 6 participants. Mm. I thought that was rather odd. So, doing the right thing, I thought, I went up to the 6 women. I said, look, hey, look, I've got over 2... The women were out in the corridor. I couldn't put them in anywhere. I said, look, I've got over 200 women wanting to come to my workshop. I said, you've got a small group. Can we swap rooms? I said, no, the rooms have been allocated. Pardon? I said, I've got over 200 women wanting to come to my workshop. Oh, what are you doing? And it's like they kept missing the point. It's like there are six of you.
That's right.
You would fit into the other room comfortably. Could we just do a swap? And they wouldn't do that. And it was like, I'm a Taurian anyway. I was also born in the year of the dog, which is an earth sign. It was like waving a red flag for me. I was so angry that morning.
Well, you would be, yeah.
So I called a meeting of the representatives of the various women's groups and Aboriginal women's groups, and I said, this is a joke. I said, we can't do this. And I gave them my example. Another woman had another example. Another woman had another. I thought, okay, we need to put a stop to this. So we stopped the conference, called an emergency meeting in the lecture theatre that the six women were in, because that was a big room. And a number of us spoke up and spoke out. I was... I can't remember what I said, but apparently I was very vocal.
And articulate, probably.
Very vocal. One of the women was a woman called Hanifa Dean Oswald, who was from the Victorian Ethnic Affairs Commission. And she and I became really good mates. She was an amazing woman, a phenomenal woman. And I said to her, this is really stupid. I mean, it's embarrassing, really, you know, to think that we as women are doing this to each other. So I'm just flies, are doing this to each other. I said, that's not good. Anyway, Freddie Steen was there from the Commonwealth, and we effectively put a stop to the conference, called the conference organisers, got everything reallocated. I had to redo the workshop, and we did it, you know. So everything became fine. And the Aboriginal women, a lot of them were from the territory, a lot of them from Pitjantjatjara lands. They weren't very vocal. They were quite shy.
Yeah, very.
Quite shy. And I said to them, look at what we're doing. I said, we call each other sisters. I think it's a joke. What sisters? There are some sisters and there are others. Where is the sisterhood in this? So where is it? And I said, it's embarrassing. If nothing else, I said, this is embarrassing. Anyway, chat. After the workshops and when the day had finished, Jo tapped me on the shoulder. She said, oh, you've got an invitation. I said, oh, okay. She said, nice. What are we doing? She said, oh, a group of the... that a group of women want you to join them. I said, oh, okay. So we went to one of the women's rooms, and there were about eight women there, all from the lands. And Jo said, they want to thank you. I'm going to start crying. I said, what for? For giving them a voice. I was profoundly, apart from being moved, I was embarrassed.
Yeah, that's right.
I was embarrassed that somebody like me, who really has no connection really with these women, would be thanked instead of the right thing being done. So that again is
that
something
it was
that shaped me.
That it was necessary in that
case. Yeah, I mean, that was another
but
thing.
But Jo was a great educator for all of us who worked at Switchboard. About Aboriginal women and Aboriginal issues, and really confronted us with our white racism,
but
especially
you see,
those of us who were middle class and had never ever thought about some of the issues.
See,
I learned a huge amount from that woman.
Liz, it wasn't a learning thing for me from her. It was just normal.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean?
That's right. Well,
when
I
was a kid, just up the road here was an Aboriginal family. I'd play with their kids. Their kids would come here. We'd play together. That would eat here, but, you know, we're just normal.
Yeah,
my parents didn't know how to discriminate back then when they first came here, and I was a little one. They didn't know. They didn't have enough information to discriminate. As far as they were concerned, they were just neighbours.
They were kids.
So I haven't grown up, you know, having any negative
connotations.
Thinking about Aboriginal people, I just didn't do that.
Yeah, well, that was good.
Across the road, there was an Italian family and another Aboriginal family. We had about three or four families living along this street.
Mm.
And we would all, in summertime when it was hot, and Dad used to work at the East End markets, he'd buy boxes of rock melons that would be about the size of my fist, and he'd get tubs of ice cream. We'd cut them in half, and we'd have like 30 kids over, where we'd scoop out the melon seeds and fill it with ice cream. We'd be eating the melon with the ice cream, and all the kids would be there. Mm. That's normal for us.
That's right.
So, you know, Switchboard, apart from the negative stuff, then there was some negative stuff, was had a profound impact on me and how I would work later. And Hanifa,
so you were there between 78 and 85 or?
Yep, I left in September 85.
September 85, okay, because I know I was away. I went away in 81, I think.
That's right.
Yeah.
You were missed.
Yeah. Well, I was having a nice time somewhere else. But anyway, so that's Switchboard was still in Kentaur Avenue.
Yes.
And most, not too many big changes really. Had we set up the Welfare Rights Centre by then? We had.
Right.
Had that come along? Had Maggie Martinelli turned up by then for the Welfare Rights Centre to get started? So that was all later. Gotcha. That happened in the late 80s then.
That's right.
Okay, because I'm trying to think. A few times I've had these discussions with people and we've thought of things that began. Were we doing phone-ins back in your day?
Yeah, housing, we did have a couple of phone-ins, yes.
Housing phone-ins. What other phone-ins were there? There was parental stress, domestic violence, women and disability. Were you involved with those? They were usually held on a Saturday or Sunday, weren't they? Often over both days?
I was always
involved. If I remember rightly.
Yeah. And because I was available. I didn't have kids, see, so I was always available. For me, the women with disability thing started fairly early because I had clients who had kids with disabilities. So I got involved in that area fairly quickly. And because I had that initial kind of experience, I guess, that whenever there was a disability issue, it would be referred to me. People thought I was comfortable in the area and certainly knowledgeable. You used to tell me off.
Did I?
Yes, you did.
About?
I would memorise information.
Mm-hmm.
I would memorise phone numbers, addresses, names, contacts and so on.
Better brain than me then.
And you kept telling me to look it up. And I said, but I remember. No point in looking it up if I remember.
No, well, that's exactly
and,
right.
And unfortunately, I still have that bad trait that my legs don't work so much anymore, but my brain is still very active and very precise. And I just have a very strong elephantine memory.
Mm, and well, that's really useful, though, Nicky.
My life
some of us have not
doesn't.
Got such a good memory.
No, Jeff doesn't.
Really, really good that other people do.
But, yes, the phone-ins were good. And I remember the major campaign we'd had, the Social Security, about women receiving a supporting parents benefit who might have had a male visitor, and often they were being cut off their pensions because of assumptions made by the department, and that was a major campaign. That was wonderful. But I mean, for me the really exciting stuff was being able to work with the Working Women's Centre and the Health Centre and the women's camps, the Greek women's camps, and being told that I would never have anyone turn up to them, that they were a waste of my time. And they just kept getting bigger and bigger. And in the end, I had to turn women away because we didn't have enough room.
Didn't have the space.
Oh.
Yeah.
And they were amazing. All these dependent Greek women leaving their families to come along on for a weekend where they were provided with a lot of information. And also, I mean, we need to... Deborah McCulloch was an amazing women's advisor, and I don't think there'll ever be somebody else like that, but we need to also give credit to the next woman who...
Rosemary Whiten?
Yeah, Rosemary.
She was very sensible.
Who was
really
very...
Very firm Wodey was wonderfully clear and firm and
Yeah, she was very practical.
Practical, down to earth.
I think she probably got the cultural diversity thing. She definitely got it better than Deborah did at the time. And she established the two radio programs for Louisa and myself.
So that's why I was about to ask you that very question. So when did the radio program start?
The radio program started in the early 1980s, and they were called Today's Woman. La Donna d'Oggi in Italian and Isimerini Gineka in Greek. Now, that was fantastic because that reached
that
so many
women. That was with
5
EBI, wasn't it?
Yes, that's right.
The so-called ethnic broadcasting station in those days. Yeah.
And now it's been taken over by SBS, so it's part of the SBS network. Back then it was independent. I think the reason that was quite... There was extraordinary for a number of reasons, primarily because it reached so many women where we could disperse information and things of interest to them. That was wonderful. It put pressure on us because there was no information in other languages that we'd just read out on air. We had to translate everything.
Mm.
That took time. To put together a half-hour radio program, as you would now be aware, takes a lot of time. I couldn't do this in my work time because it wasn't considered to be my work. My work was to be on the phone and to deal with the women ringing up or coming into the office. So this time, and I think this is one of the things that Louisa was very bitter about, that was never acknowledged as being our work. The time I spent on that was my own time, and nobody ever got that.
No, that's ridiculous. Yeah.
So all of the hours that I spent...
With hindsight, you would wish that it had been very different, but everyone who I've spoken to over the last 20-odd years has always said one of the most important things about Switchboard back at the beginning was those two radio programs. So they may not have been recognised and valued then, but in retrospect, they certainly are.
I think what happened is that a lot of the Greek women and Italian women of the time probably had the best information and the best sources of information they could possibly have. That was exciting. I mean, I deal with fairly... Louisa was a little bit more conservative than me, and I was a bit more, I don't know, not radical. I mean, I just thought there was information that women had to have, so if it was about sexually transmitted disease, then I'd pass it on.
Mm.
I mean, not pass it on, but I'd provide information about it. If it was about... family law issues or family violence issues. I mean, Switchboard was very much a part of getting what we used to call restraining orders in place.
Mm.
I did a lot of work with the police back then, mostly in my own time, again, because that wasn't really part of my job.
Yeah, I know. It's crazy, isn't it?
Okay. I was young and carefree and had no commitments, so that was all okay. It was so vital that we did that sort of extracurricular stuff because that was the only way that we could initiate any kind of change for women whose first language was not English.
Mm.
And at the time, that extracurricular stuff was really not perceived as being important or being part of work. That was seen to be advocacy rather than information, and I could never quite understand that. Later in life, having been in advocacy roles and managing advocacy services and chairing them and all that sort of stuff, for me there's quite a clear delineation in being an advocate and providing information, and what we were doing was definitely providing information.
And you were the only source of information for a lot of those women who didn't get out of the house. They couldn't turn their radio on during the day.
That's
when
exactly
they
right.
had their children and they could listen.
And we were anonymous.
In their own language and they could be anonymous. And it's very important.
Very.
Yeah.
It was like, I don't know whether you remember, the family law handbook that I developed for the use of our staff and our volunteers, where it was just a very simple go-to resource about family law that a lot of our volunteers complained that they really didn't get the Family Law Act and what was available. And I wrote a handbook. Mm-hmm. Don't even know what's happened to that. But it's like I was dealing with women's shelters all the time.
Oh, yeah.
They would contact me all the time because of the Greek women that they have in them and they didn't know what to do. And I had the idea of developing a shelter for women of non-English speaking background. And I must have a giggle. When the women's Margaret Women's Shelter turned 20, I went along to the birthday party and they were talking about blah, 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 blah. And I said, no, you have your history wrong. No, you didn't do that. I did. Nobody remembered that I actually wrote the first women's submission for that.
Mm. Yeah, I know. There's a lot of things that get lost in the mists of time.
It's a lot of people taking credit for things that they shouldn't take credit for.
Yeah, I know, but they do. It does happen.
I know.
And it gets forgotten by others, you know.
And it's like, and they looked at me and said, who are you? And I said, oh, blah, blah. Oh, yes, I've heard about you. And I said, well, you should. I wrote the first submission. I still have copies of it.
Hmm. Actually, you should provide copies of that to both WIS and put them in the State Library because
I have a lot of information that I probably need to give them into the State Library.
You need to give to the State Library because there is a real... If anyone tries to write a history... At one stage, I had a vague idea as part of... I was going to do a master's and I was going to write a story of the history of the Women's Information Service. I had this wild plan at one stage and then I decided it was just too big and there wasn't good enough resources to do it. And I gave up and thought, why am I doing this and is there any point? So I wasn't going to do it. But for the future, it's a really important resource that I've given a lot of the materials I had. Because remember that Every Woman's Survival Guide? Do you remember that? Well, I've given all my copies of all of that materials. I've given to the State Library. So it would be a good thing to do, Nikki, and to link it to this Women's History Project.
Oh.
Because then it will get used in a more... And it's an opportunity.
I'll get Ben to...
It's an opportunity. I know you're busy and you've got lots of things to do, but it's an opportunity this year when they're reflecting over the 40 years and there will be huge gaps in their knowledge that they don't have.
And Ben to bring my boxes down.
Provide some of that stuff to them would be really valuable, I think. Because you remember stuff that I can't remember, you know, and we were there for some time together. And yet I don't remember some of the things that you remember. Or I wasn't at the same meetings or I was busy off with my small children and doing other things. And I was a volunteer in those days, you know.
You know that I was the first person to ever write about family violence in the immigrant family. I'm using language that was used at the time.
Yeah, that's right.
But
yep.
I was the first person to write about violence in the Greek community. And just linked it to some of the medications these women were on because they were all like heavily medicated. It's crap. And some of the most horrendous acts of violence that I came across were from... because I was dealing with the people from non-English speaking background, not in Greeks, but I dealt with Italian, French, German. I speak some of those languages as well. Louise's Italian and German was much better than mine, but we both muddled through a number of languages together. And I worked with Penny Strawn, who was one of the lawyers employed by Rosemary.
Oh, Penny Stratton.
Yes.
Stratman, I think. Penny Stratman. Yeah, she later became the... administrator of Government House, being the link between the governor and the bureaucracy. Oh. So she did very well, Penny. She's a lovely woman.
She is lovely. Yeah. She worked with me because of libel. I had to be careful. But that sort of got me... it's interesting. It got me recognised as being somebody who knew about family violence issues and the area of that. It also got me smacked by George Papadopoulos, who was the chairman of the Victorian Ethnic Affairs Commission back then. So, you know, you've got to be really... Because he was worried about stereotyping. And it's like, these are based on the cases with which I've worked, so there's no libel issue there. I said this has been checked by a lawyer. He was trying to scare me because
he didn't want anyone criticising his community.
He later apologised, which I thought was really cute when I worked for him.
Yeah. But you were that right, was, no, I was wrong.
yeah. You know, it's like... Because, as you kept saying, I was the only one, or Louisa was the only one to do this, we had a choice. We could either raise these issues as being issues of concern so that something could be done.
Mm.
And me raising this issue, writing about violence, writing the submission for a women's shelter, raised enough awareness for other people to go and do things. Mm. That's I'm happy with that.
Yeah.
I'm happy to be planting the seeds. That was my role,
yeah,
in terms of being providing information or getting using the information that I was getting, putting it together and having somebody else move with it. And I love being in that position.
Mm. Well, lots of things grew out of Switchboard. Like,
oh, yeah.
Having that women's family law advice on a yes. Saturday afternoon, that yes. probably grew out of your little brochure.
Yeah.
Having volunteer lawyers, and I still see a lot of those volunteer lawyers around town today,
yeah.
who remember very clearly coming in to answer those calls yes. on a Saturday afternoon, yep. or eventually we got the technology where we could switch the calls through That's to right. them at home, and they just had to sit by their home phone. And the Women's Legal Service today wouldn't exist
no.
without all that work
no.
that you and others did at that time.
You know, we
putting that service together and making it happen.
I remember on the weekends in particular having phone calls from women who would be in absolute terror. And these would be women who are very middle class women, often married to people in the legal profession or to people who had very significant social status.
Hmm.
And they would say, how can I leave? I am bound. I can't.
Doctors' wives.
Yes, exactly.
Police officers' wives.
Exactly.
Those people were really tied up in...
Not books. Police officers. I'm talking much higher up.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm talking about really significant positions. And it would be... Like, I mean, I'd have a woman call me week after week because I'd often work Sunday nights because nobody else wanted to when we were working Sunday nights. And she said to me, all I have is your voice. She said, I never want to meet you. I just want to know that you're listening to me.
Mm. Yes, the role of being an ear and being a non-judgmental, empowering, listening ear was very important for a lot of women, especially at nights and weekends when they were lonely yeah. and sad and unhappy and they felt like there was no one they could talk to. It was very important, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I still remember this woman saying to me, I won't ring you soon, you won't hear from me. And she said, I will kill myself. And then you won't hear from me. So there came a time where one Sunday, whatever she rang, I didn't hear from her and I thought, oh, okay. Didn't think much of it. Then 2 or 3 weeks later, I thought, and I was too frightened to go and look at the papers.
Mm.
Didn't yes. want to do that.
Well, you didn't always. That was one of the things about working there that women I've talked to who work there now still find, is that not knowing the end of the story, you may have helped at a specific moment in time, but you didn't ever always hear the end of the story, and it's quite rare that you get approached at the markets by somebody who's yeah, saying, you saved my life. And you don't actually need that no. after a while. But when you first start, I think that's the thing I used to find the hardest when I was first to volunteer, not knowing what happened. The end of the story.
Yeah.
And there is no end of most people's stories.
I was just
stories.
Going to say
yeah, that's right. It really but it took a while to learn that. Yeah, for me, that I took a while
I
to learn
I remember having
yeah.
a client whose child was removed by forceps, and he sustained quite a severe disability. And she knew why he had that disability, and she was fighting the doctor for years. And she was from another state. She came to Adelaide because there was family here, and she ended up at Switchboard. Really amazing woman, and this amazing little kid that she totally devoted herself towards. And he had intellectual disability, because and she was convinced of this. So we put her onto one of Switchboard's best lawyers, and what a legal team we had behind us. Wow, they were extraordinary. We had some of the best people behind us supporting us. We were supporting them because they were getting clients. I get that. But these really top-notch lawyers often went a step beyond
what they needed to do. Yeah, above and beyond.
Because of our it was a shaky association to start with.
Mm.
But I think once we managed to convince them that we will do the preparatory work for them and, you know, get that all prepared so the woman can just go and say whatever and we'd be there for her support, then that was all cool. Mm. But anyway, she ended up winning a case, and it took, I think she came in when I was there, my third year, probably took 2 years, and that was finalised before I left to go to Melbourne. And one of the really exciting things for me is that in 1985, this young man became chairperson of the MALSA, which was the disability advocacy organisation that I was supporting at that time, and I was chairing.
Yeah,
and he became chairperson after me because I had to leave, and he was part of my team beforehand. And we working with him, he became so confident and able to do things, and fantastic, really really happy. That he was also doing some extraordinary work with IT, running his own business and doing very well. So that is a good
story. Yeah, sometimes you heard the end of the story, but mostly you didn't, and you had to deal with it. Okay, can you think of any other... Do you think there's still a need for an information service for women? Because this is a question that comes up periodically. Some governments decide that it's not necessary. What do you think?
There will always be a need for women's information service. It, quite simply, women, I think, even now, even young women, prefer to speak to other women, number one. The level, and I'm not saying men are not empathic, I'm fortunate to have an incredibly empathic man in my life, but I think there's a different kind of empathy with women. And women... I think women do have expectations of services, and I think they often get very disappointed with the services that they get to. And there's both a familiarity as well as an anonymity in dealing with the women's information service that is safe and reliable for women. And just having been away from that for a while, I've become very much aware as to how unreliable information sources are, especially government.
And especially the internet.
Facebook. Internet's a joke. And unless you know how to navigate it properly, then you can be caught. But the internet and cyberspace provides a whole range of different types of danger for women.
Oh, yes.
And I don't know how much the Women's Information Service is prepared for that, but for that alone, yes, we need a Women's Information Service. Mm. But I suspect that we need to be much more informed about cyberspace and some of the dangers that lurk therein. And I also think there's a role for the Women's Information Service to provide information more widely to women about some issues. Like we did the radio program.
Those sort of programs, that's right.
The radio programs are extremely successful in their time for reaching their target group. The funding, I'm sure, has been removed, and I think it was taken over and became a bit of a joke in that it was becoming an entertainment program rather than an information program.
There was a lot of music in the end, whereas wasn't there?
With me, it was really hardcore.
Yeah.
Hardcore information and very ideologically sounded music.
Yeah, I'm not sure when who was the last Greek worker? There was Sophie Rose after you and Stella Hollander. Well, Mavrogeorgis later Hollander, and I'm not sure if there was another Greek worker after she left.
I suspect there wasn't, because it was assumed that the demographics would change and there were other more emerging groups that are necessary. The thing that has saddened me is that, and I have this argument with people all the time, there will never be enough workers for the cultural diversity that we deal with. We're not going to get it.
No.
What we need is for the existing workers to be competently trained.
Culturally
so that they, yeah. Well, it is culture competency, but they need how to use interpreters. They need how to learn how to do that. They need how to shift their thinking. I do a lot of culture competency training. That's one of the areas I specialise in these days.
Mm.
And the days of cultural awareness have well and truly gone. That does mean nothing.
No, that's
but
right.
You give them to me for a couple of days and I set them right.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I learnt from Switchwell was that need for proper interpreters.
Yeah.
And as part of my work at the Legal Services Commission, I ran a whole lot of training programs from workers from new and emerging communities, so the Afghanis and the Africans, all the different languages. I encouraged them to come and learn about the Australian law, because they were going to court, not understanding our court system.
Yeah, I know.
And yet being expected to interpret. So we did a lot of training about all those things
while I
was at the commission, and I learnt that from Switchboard. You and Louisa taught me that.
Interpreters need training.
What was required, and we made sure all the interpreters, at the time when I was at the commission, we ran so many different programs and I got funding for it, so that we could make sure that interpreters understood the court system, that they understood legal terminology, because that's not easy at all.
No.
You know, we have quaint sayings like, I put it to you. Now, what does that mean in English, really? I put it to you and that's commonly used by a lot of lawyers, and lawyers are still not being taught to use plain English, which makes it impossible for someone to interpret.
Right.
And they wonder why sometimes there are cases that have been appealed on the basis of poor interpreting. And we did a whole lot of work with Aboriginal people about Aboriginal interpreting, because particularly those communities up in the APY lands and others have been hugely disadvantaged in many different cases because of the poor quality and the lack of training and the lack of funding for providing a proper interpreter service. So I learned all that from Louisa and Joe and others about interpreters.
It's been really important. I remember just before I left to go to Melbourne, I was invited it was here. One of the interests that I have is cultural competency, psychiatric practice, and mental health practice, and cross-cultural psychiatry issues have been part of what I've done for quite a while now. And I remember being invited to be part of a panel by, and I won't name anyone, but by a man who was a significant figure in what he thought was culturally competent psychiatry. And he invited all the ethnic communities and service providers to a huge conference, workshop, forum thing at the parks.
Mm-hmm.
And he rang me up and he said, Nikki, what we'd like, because at that time I was the chairperson of the Greek Australian Welfare Workers Association.
Mm-hmm.
We'd like you to talk about blah, 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 blah. And I'm thinking to myself, you've got to be joking. I said, okay, I'll do that. And he wanted me to talk about the psychiatric needs of my community and how we, mother community, dealt with them. And I said, I'd have one request. Yeah, I said, I'm very busy, but I do have one request. Said, oh, yeah, what is it? And I said, I want to speak last. I want you to put everybody else first, and I will speak last. In the meantime, I had spoken to people like, you don't know, Helena Kyriazopoulos and some of the other kind of important people in the ethnic affairs area, and said to them, oh, I've been asked to do this, and they kind of laughed, and they said, what are you going to do? And I said, nothing. I just want you to be there. So this is when I was working in aged care. So in fact, I wasn't at Switchboard at that time.
So you moved on,
I was at GOXA, the Greek Orthodox Community. That's the thing that I learned at Switchboard. He'd heard about me from...
Yeah. When you were at Switchboard.
When I was at Switchboard. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So he had somebody from the Italian community, the Greek community, the Middle Eastern community, the Vietnamese community, the Chinese and whatever. There were about 6 or 7 panel members. So everybody got up and did their thing, and funnily enough, they all said the same thing, which I thought was rather extraordinary, really, or not really. Then it was my turn, and I got up and I started off by saying that being only one person, I couldn't possibly represent the interests of 35,000 people in my community because it's not possible. And I said, besides which, I think schizophrenia is probably the same for everyone, the same imbalance, the same thing. I said, but we don't have the problem. It's the same for us. Same for my Italian friends. It's the same. I said, it's not our problem. I said, it's your problem. You're the ones who are not trained properly to deal with us. You're the ones who aren't trained to use interpreters effectively or properly. You're the ones whose workplace doesn't support you. You're the ones who do this. So I just threw it all back on the service providers.
And you
learned
that.
That's where the problem lied. It didn't lie with the community.
No.
The problem was the service providers had no frigging idea as to what to do. And it's like, oh, let's find out what they do with schizophrenia in their community or anxiety or whatever it is. And so it's all the same.
Yeah, of course it is. Okay, well, we've got a couple more areas that we need to quickly look at.
But that's the kind
most
of system.
Topics we have covered. Do you have any comments about using new technology and the introduction of the internet and information sources at the very beginning, those famous pink cards? And then those very basic computers that
went. The Rolodex. My God, I don't even remember computers at Switchboard. I think I got computers when I went to Melbourne.
We did have them. We got them.
1985? Really? I don't think so.
I think we had some in the back room and we were printing out the pink cards.
Yeah.
Before I went overseas, we were printing, typing them up and printing them out. And that was a really basic program.
Yeah.
And then in about 1990, we actually got our first little network of computers.
Yeah, that was after.
Yeah, so that was after you came.
No, obviously in the dark ages.
Yeah. So you were there. And so what were your main sources of information? Where did you find your information for people?
Well,
we had the famous pink cards.
I mean, apart from the sort of standard stuff that I've memorised, much to your chagrin, I think a lot of our information was mainly from pamphlets, so actually bringing the people directly and finding out from them.
Mm.
Don't forget that...
We had that yellow book, the Kisser Directory. Was that around
then?
No,
the Rolodex.
We didn't have the Kisser Directory then, the Directory of Information Services. That must have come later then.
Must have been later.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. And we used the telephone book a lot when I was
that's right.
There. The telephone book was very helpful and the yellow pages.
It was, but
anymore.
For us, the kinds of information that women wanted generally were really quite specific. Again, if it was a health-related matter, we'd refer on.
Mm.
And if it was a workers-related matter, we'd generally refer on. For the more complex legal stuff, there really wasn't anything to do other than to make a time with a woman, see if she would come in so we could take some notes and prepare that. to go with her to a lawyer. We couldn't do that because we couldn't provide any legal advice at the time.
That's right, yeah.
So that was our role, really. We did provide information, but that was limited. It was more taking that a step further and getting the woman to, teaching the woman how to prepare herself in order to then go on to a lawyer, and that's the information we'd provide, or to legal aid or whatever was appropriate. But things like emergency housing or the housing trust or any like that thing like that, there wasn't
still
really
a problem.
Housing is still really an issue. Good relationships with the emergency housing office.
But I know, really, but good. It's still an issue. There was still,
but there was
enough.
No housing. There was nothing
that's
available.
Right. Yeah, I know.
And with housing trust stuff, it was primarily assisting women with filling in forms and
writing letters of support. And you and Louisa were really good at that.
We did tons of that.
I know.
Tons of that. But yeah, so that's really, I can't really answer that.
Yeah, that's all right.
We had no technology apart from the phone, really.
Yeah, that's right.
And our own networks that developed and grew as we developed and grew.
Oh, well, that's right. And everyone shared information too.
Yes.
Someone knew something that someone else would help.
That's something we were good at.
And the relationships of monitoring and assisting volunteers, I found that to be really valuable. That there was always someone around who you could talk to and who you could debrief with. That kind of collaborative working ethos was really important, wasn't it?
I think, between the paid staff and the volunteers, that was really good.
And I think we all learnt a lot from each other
Absolutely.
In that way,
like
we?
I said at the beginning, the amount of diversity in our volunteers and what they were able to offer was extraordinary. Just absolutely extraordinary.
Yeah, it's still good. Okay, so is there anything else that you would like to add to your reflections upon your time at the Women's Information Service and how it affected the rest of your career? Because quite a few women have said to me it really formed a lot of my attitudes to my later work. Has that been something you would respond to?
I mean, Switchboard was the best training ground I could have imagined. I mean, I went on to finish a social work degree when I was in Victoria. The government there sponsored me. I think they were embarrassed that, you know, their assistant director of a government department didn't have a degree finished, so they did that.
Yep, good.
I think it taught me resilience more than anything. Taught me to have faith in myself, but also not to be egotistical about it. There are, unfortunately, areas where I specialise in now, and unfortunately there aren't many people who do what I do. You know, especially in the areas of aged care and disability, or the ageing of disability, or looking at really big picture stuff. And I think I learnt that not at Switchboard, but when I moved on to Melbourne. I was headhunted basically for a position in Melbourne, which was for me to be there, the Victorian Ethic Affairs Commission's women's advisor, women's policy officer, and learnt to develop and write policy in Victoria based on my experience and based on 1984 when Hanifa watched me in action to deal with what I was dealing with at the conference.
So all that experience has informed your later practice.
But it I think for me, Switchboard really gave me a band of ethics that are incredibly important to me, even though a lot of feminists back then didn't think that I was a feminist. I think it's hysterical.
There are many feminisms, I always say. There are as many feminisms as there are feminists. Don't you think?
And it's about, I don't deny my self-worth. I don't deny the self-worth of any woman. I still prefer women to men. I still think that the majority of men are dickheads. But that will never leave me. That's just how I am. Just because I know that there are two or three exceptions in my life, doesn't mean that my opinion of men has changed much at all. I probably would have made a really good lesbian had I been that way inclined. It's just that I wasn't. There you go. It also... Oh, sorry. I guess it... all the cultural competency stuff, all the issues about equity and what that really means, all the stuff that government touts about individualised services and what the individual means, I have a very clear perception of what that is for me, whereas a lot of people caught in systems don't. Individual for them is what they're funded to do and not what the person is. So that's the difference for me. And I guess Switchboard provided me with a very profound and very deep understanding of Aboriginal issues. And I don't mean that in a kind of the fashion sense, and I get really upset with people calling them Indigenous. It's like they don't like that.
Well, some do, some don't. It depends
on a lot of the younger people are liking that because that's what they're familiar with. But if you talk to the elders, no, they don't. They want to be called Aboriginal people.
Yeah, except the Torres Strait Islanders don't want to be. And there are fewer of them down here, so it's complicated, isn't it?
Yeah, I know. You call Torres Strait Islanders the Islander people. You know,
that's right.
There's ways of doing it.
Of course there are.
The other thing it taught me, Switchboard taught me, is the importance and power of language and how we categorise people very easily with the language that we use, and that's something that I'm quite conscious of.
Okay, well, thank you, Nikki Dimitropoulos, for giving us your time so generously. It's been a pleasure to share our reflections upon your time at the Women's Information Switchboard. And I think that's concludes our interview. So thank you very much.